KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
North Korea. Otherwise, you cannot get out of this vicious circle of crime and punishment and crime and punishment.
North Korea. That's what we're taking up just ahead on Weekday. We're also going to talk about tracking global health factors, and we'll talk to Neil Barofsky on the financial meltdown and the fail of the bailout. When Dennis Rodman, bejeweled former NBA player, announced he was going on vacation with Kim Jong-un, what Dennis Rodman was thinking, but maybe they'll have more time on the court, less time for Kim to rattle nuclear weapons. North Korea recently threatened the U.S., Japan, South Korea because of new United Nations sanctions. And yesterday, Kim Jong-un oversaw an artillery drill near a disputed South Korean border. So tensions, are they rising? Is this theater? What should we think about it? Donald Hellman is a professor of political science and professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the UW. I think the only person I've ever met who's been to North Korea, right?
Yes.
Just a handful of folks.
Yes.
All right. So it's good to see you. Tell me something. When I talk about Dennis Rodman, I talk about him meeting with Kim, and then you look at the coverage, and here's a picture I just brought up: Kim and his generals, I guess, looking at this artillery drill. What's the coverage in America like? How do you feel about it? I'm going to start with media a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start, because the flow of information from North Korea is, to put it mildly, distorted and limited. It's kind of a black hole, and therefore almost anybody's opinion, even Dennis Rodman's, gets heard. I find this bizarre, given the play that Rodman has received, and others. Jane Fonda did this in Hanoi at the end of the Vietnam War and later admitted that she'd been sold a bill of goods. I don't know whether Dennis is capable of acknowledging that or not, but I think that it's not just Rodman's trip. It's the whole hype that surrounds the rhetoric that Kim Jong-un is engaged in right now. Most of these threats cannot really be carried out militarily. A threat to launch a three-stage intercontinental ballistic missile with accuracy and deliver it to the United States is clearly not within their range right now. But they can go after Japan and regional areas, just South Korea.
Well, so forth. Do they want to?
I can't imagine. They would be destroyed. It's like either a kamikaze or a jihadist foreign policy, because they know perfectly well, especially if they use nuclear weapons, that the retaliation would be immediate from the United States and maybe even from others, certainly South Korea, and would be utterly devastating. It would be essentially an admission that they want to go down. There's no way they can conquer South Korea. And they don't need nuclear weapons to inflict devastating impact on the South. They have hardened missiles and tanks and artillery that could take out a third to a half of Seoul. I mean, trillions of dollars of damage and millions of people.
And then the response.
Yeah, the response would be devastating.
So give me the geopolitical assessment of why a new, young, untested, perhaps not very well-informed leader would take this on, or his deputies or his generals.
Well, that's a good question, and it's been answered in very ambiguous and foolish ways. I mean, obviously, someone who's been migrating in and out of school and playing pickup basketball in Switzerland, who is suddenly placed in charge of a country that is utterly, they have a gulag, 200,000 political prisoners, the people cannot be fed. They're being kept alive basically by fuel and food sent in from China. To put someone with essentially zero experience in this in charge tells you, first of all, that he's probably not the one making the decisions,
yeah.
And therefore focusing on him is, I think, a mistake.
Well, are there people to focus on? I mean, are there people, individuals that you know from your studies that you would focus on, Donald?
Well, even people who study it, I suppose the South Korean intelligence is the best, most informed group on the individuals involved, but it's the military. It's the military connections and friends of the Kim family who are basically taking him under their wing. And no one knows, I emphasize, no one knows, mostly personal and naked power that may be going on in Pyongyang to decide which particular hysterical, rhetorical button they push. I think the only thing that's...
I like that image. Yeah. They have a little display panel of hysterical responses they can use.
Yeah, they're doing well on it. I mean, it's kind of like a Hollywood movie set. I mean, since half of these things they are not going to implement, those that they do implement are horrific in the sense they sink ships, they kill innocent people in South Korea, and so on. But it's, you know, the rhetoric is threatening to attack the United States is just rhetoric. I mean,
so what do the Chinese say about this? I mean, you study China, you've been to China. China's there, both their protector, their benefactor, also right now sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the Chinese?
Well, there's a China. You're right. China is the key to without Chinese economic aid. Nominally, they actually have a security treaty from 1962 with North Korea. So technically they're allied. But China has also now become a global power. Except that the conventional explanation of Chinese behavior is that China does not want the North to collapse. And the reason they don't want it to collapse is that there would be all more or less instant migration of several million North Koreans that would affect certainly the area immediately abutting North Korea. That's one reason. A second reason is that Americans and South Koreans then would move right up to the Alu River and China would be. And I think that is hyperbolic. I can imagine the United States invading China or conspiring to invade China. This is silly.
Do they still fear a South Korea, on a United Korean Peninsula that would include South Korea all the way to the Yalu?
That's the standard, as I use the word conventional. That's the conventional explanation to explain Chinese behavior. I think it's very tenuous. Obviously, all things being equal, they would prefer a puppet state. I'm not sure they have one right now that is friendly to them and they can manipulate like a puppet. The real geopolitical, answer your question, the real geopolitical concerns about all this are if one of the collateral effects of the collapse of North Korea or even the intensification of threat that might lead to is the possibility that both Japan and South Korea themselves could go nuclear. And it's not a technical or a money problem for either one of them. My guess is Japan could do it apropos of Fukushima. They could probably do it in a couple of weeks, certainly no more than a month. And South Korea, I think, is pretty close as well. And that would present the Chinese with a problem that goes way beyond Pyongyang. If you have a nuclearized Northeast Asia, then, you know, the role of the United States and everybody else suddenly becomes even somewhat more marginal to all this.
Donald Hellman is a professor of political science, professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the UW. talking about North Korea. North Korea accused the U.S. and South Korea of cyber attacks just today, and that blaming the intermittent access to the web Wednesday, Thursday on cyber attacks. Who knows, right?
Who knows? But given the paucity of cyber activities in North Korea, I find this another kind of preposterous. I think the cyber debate that's suddenly been thrust upon us, at this point, pointing particularly to China, is a serious and interesting one. I think it's exaggerated in terms of its imminence, but North Korea, I don't know how many computers they have operative, and they surely do not have their utilities and various other infrastructure the way we do or any developed nation does.
You know, you mentioned that China and the U.S., Japan, South Korea. I mean, in some ways, North Korea seems like it could be like an inflamed appendix to global politics. It could burst and it could take a lot of people down with it. At the same time, how does it affect? Does it bring the U.S. and China closer together in trying to deal with this? Does it drive us further apart?
Well, that's interesting question, because certainly during the early part of this century, when George W. Bush was president, there was a real opportunity to lead a coalition against North Korea with a six-party. That might have worked. The Chinese would have dragged their feet, but had we taken the initiative in the six-party talks, we talk as if we started them. The Chinese started them. These were held in Beijing. Multilateralism was not part of our lexicon. That was for political consumption in this country. Yes, we operated multilaterally, but the whole notion of leading that multilateral operation never had we chosen to lead at that point before the Great Recession, we would have had a chance to bring economic pressures to bear on China that might have made it possible to put pressure on the North. Now, certainly for the last 4 or 5 years, that notion of our putting economic pressure on China is gone. I think the second and most important part is the Chinese are changing. The Chinese significantly voted for these increased sanctions, which won't amount to much. But symbolically, that's very important. And I think the reason for doing this is that the mercurial, unpredictable nature of the North, these wild threats that could genuinely stimulate nationalism and possibly even rearmament of some modest sort, both in South and North, South Korea and Japan. These are items on the priority items on the Chinese foreign policy agenda.
Do you worry at all about North Korea having a nuclear weapon that it does share with other actors in the world? Or are those sanctions strong enough to ameliorate that?
I think the chances of their playing an active role in supplying terrorists, which is the real threat, is relatively low. We have in place this is one of the earlier sanctions, is to inspect and to see if they are in any way doing, you know, exporting materials, not so much the. And so I think if you want that kind of, you're talking about proliferation of nuclear technology, Iran would be better situated geographically. And I think the dissemination of it, of nuclear capacity, would come more from initiatives that are political, not technical in nature, to be honest with you. Hmm. After all, Pakistan's bomb is called the Islamic bomb, and it was primarily paid for by Saudi Arabia. And which is, you know, again, all lost in the contemporary discussion.
So where does this play out over the next few weeks as we continue to see these headlines? How should we as consumers take them, and how might it play out globally?
Well, I think our best hope is that China, who does have a capacity to shape the policies of the country by outside pressure, by cutting supplies of oil, by cutting trade. They invest in it. It's a fairly reasonably porous border. If China could be convinced, or chooses more accurately, to increase that kind of pressure, and we cooperate with them, then I think things will work out. What I object to in the dialogue that's going on in this country is everybody conjectures about the internal politics of North Korea and whether Kim Jong-un is sane or is Dennis Rodman going to get a Nobel Prize for Peace or something. I mean, this is all just silliness and a function of, you know, a drama that has legs only because the media chooses to give it legs, in my opinion.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. That sounds a little hopeful, actually. We'll leave it there. Donald Hellman is professor of political science, professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the UW. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It's Weekday.
It's 9:22. KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's tour is Thursday, March 21st at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For more than three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
52 degrees in Seattle. Today's high in the mid-50s with clouds and showers likely. Also breezy, a wind 8 to 13 miles an hour. Tonight, expect a low in the upper 40s with clouds and a 40% chance of showers.
That conversation about the bailout, how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street, coming up in about 9-10 minutes. But first, scientists are trying to apply big data to help them see trends and solve problems. At the UW, a department looking at health trends globally has found some disturbing trends in global health. Alzheimer's disease, the fastest growing threat to health in the U.S. In Russia, HIV/AIDS and alcohol are the threat. It's a homicide crisis in Latin America, and infectious diseases still kill too many children across sub-Saharan Africa. The Global Burden of Diseases, Injuries, and Risk Factors Study, started in 1990 with prompting from the World Bank, allows scientists to compare trends across time and regions. It's led by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington with worldwide collaborators. Dr. Christopher Murray of the UW directed the study. We spoke from D.C., where he is meeting with White House advisors about some of the findings.
Well, they're particularly interested in the results around the risk factor assessment for the United States, and which is part of the burden of disease work, because it fundamentally, we have data on every country, and I think it's part of the focus of the Let's Move campaign led out of by the First Lady of the White House. They have a strong interest in the findings around physical activity, diet, and obesity. So that was the topic of the conversation.
What did the global data tell you about Americans' movements or the diseases related to that versus the rest of the population, rest of the world's population?
Well, what we see is that, first of all, no surprise, obesity is very much on the rise, and what ends up happening is that it's almost as big a risk for overall health in the U.S. as smoking. But I think the finding that's perhaps the most surprising to us is that even larger than smoking as a huge important risk in the United States, its diet is actually somewhat ahead of tobacco. And by diet, I mean not we've separately quantified in the Global Burden of Disease study 15 different components of diet, And, you know, if you look at the online tools that we have, GBD Compare, for example, you can see for each country in the U.S., what's the contribution of nuts and seeds and fruit and vegetables and salts intake right through a whole a long series. And if you put them all together, the totality of what we eat accounts for a larger fraction of premature mortality and burden in the U.S. than tobacco, which means there's huge potential for us to improve health by changing diet.
Dr. Christopher Murray is director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the UW. Let me take a step back. What's the design of this big study? What was the major design?
Well, this study is an enormous global collaboration with almost 500 scientists from 50 countries, from more than 300 different institutions, working together over 5 years to try to all the world's evidence to quantify what's the size of different health problems. You know, how big is heart disease? How big is cancer of different types? How big is malaria? How big are different risk factors that explain the patterns of disease and injury we see, and do this all using a comparable set of approaches. The big focus or the big contribution, I believe, from this effort, this collaborative effort, is the ability to make comparisons over time for a country and between countries across age groups, across sex. And that ability to compare is suddenly you see things that you don't normally see. You get the big picture, and some of the visual tools we've created that are online now help everybody, not just health specialists, I think, see that big picture.
Global metrics get applied.
Well, the capacity to see, you know, whether breast cancer, for example, is going up or down, and whether it's the leading cancer for women or not, or some other cancer is, like cervical cancer, I mean, that's the first step towards informed both medical care programs and public health strategies. And so understanding what our problems are and tracking if they're getting worse or better is, you know, just the most basic building block for making progress. You know, for example, in the U.S., the huge rise of Alzheimer's is sounding the alarm and means that we need to pay more attention to what might be explaining the big increases in Alzheimer's disease, and hopefully that'll lead us in the direction of what can be done, both by individuals and through medical care or through public health interventions.
Dr. Christopher Murray is director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at UW, a global health doctor. How does this apply in King County, for example, where lots of studies are done about health metrics and health policy?
Well, you know, part of our mission is to both look globally, but also to look within the U.S. and within Washington State and try to use the same approach to measurement of health to get some insights into what's happening. And we've been working with King County, trying to use some innovative approaches to measurement to get a much deeper understanding is to, you know, for example, why do people have poor outcomes in different parts of King County? Why are there disparities between, you know, the South Seattle and other parts of Seattle? Can we understand that in terms of specific diseases, heart attacks? Is it what happens when they leave the hospital? And that and we don't have the answers yet, but I believe that that sort of in-depth local assessment and trying to build up that type of monitoring system will start to give us insights into where we could actually act in our own setting to see improved outcomes.
Do you have a specific example of how that might work?
Well, sure. I mean, take, for example, the people, a big problem in the U.S. Are those people who suffer from heart failure. It's a common-ish problem. There's probably more than 1 million people in the U.S. with heart failure. And frequently they end up being hospitalized multiple times, even in the course of a year, because of complications. And we also know that effective drugs for heart failure can reduce those rates of complication and reduce mortality quite substantially. And we're trying to figure out what fraction of people are getting prescribed the right medication, and you know, a year out, let's say, are they still on the medication, and are they getting the benefit that's possible? And I think, you know, the answer we're seeing in some cases is no, for a variety of reasons, people may not be getting the benefit that's possible from known interventions. And, of course, then the next step is to figure out ways in which that can occur. So I think there's a way to connect up the measurement of what's happening to very concrete, specific ways that the health system, physicians, the public health system can help people get better outcomes.
You know, I was struck by one thing, and I wonder how you expectancy of American women increased over 20 years from 78 years to 80 years, and men had a lower but similar increase, but only 69.5 of those 80.5 years for women were lived in good health, and similarly for American men. Well, I guess it's a global shift. We have an older population, but it doesn't necessarily mean that living longer means you're going to live healthy all those years.
Well, certainly, because in the burden of disease study, we're looking at both death, but also the prevalence of 1,160 different disease outcomes, and trying to take into account how severe they are. And put that all together, we do get this insight into how much time people spend with one, two, three, or more different disorders. And unfortunately, they tend to accumulate with age. And so as people get into their 70s and 80s, a lot of people have multiple conditions that they're grappling with. And that's part of these longer lifespans. But there's also a lot that can be done to make people's lives, you know, higher quality in terms of their health outcomes. And that's sort of part of the driver, I believe, of why we need to pay attention to this rise of chronic disability and come up with the best strategies for both preventing it but also ameliorating it.
Dr. Christopher Murray directs the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the UW. Links to the findings from the Global Burden of Disease Study at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:33, KUOW 94.9. Otis Williams is the last surviving member of Motown group The Temptations. He talks about their music this afternoon at 1:40.
Support for KUOW comes from Edible Seattle magazine, presenting the 9th annual Seattle Edible Book Festival at Portage Bay Cafe, Sunday, April 7th. A benefit for Fair Start, which combines literary and culinary arts. Information on participation at edibleseattle.com. Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, providing a selection of two-sided, flippable mattresses designed for lasting comfort. Learn more about flippable mattresses at bedroomsandmore.com.
52 degrees in Seattle, expecting cool and cloudy conditions this weekend. A high of about 50 degrees. Today's high, a little warmer in the mid-50s. And we'll have a complete look at this weekend's weather from climatologist Nick Bond. That's coming up this morning at 9:55.
In the chronology of the collapse of the U.S. economy, it was about 5 years ago that J.P. Morgan agreed to buy Bear Stearns with the help from with pressure from the government in a deal that valued their shares at about $2 each. It was the beginning of the government effort to bail out the too-big-to-fail banks and what brought us the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP, and the financial crash. So how did we all fare in that financial crash? Neil Borofsky is a senior fellow at the New York University School of Law, but he was former inspector general for the federal government's Troubled Asset Relief Program. He's now a contributor to Bloomberg TV as well, and an author of Bailout, How Washington Abandoned Main Street While Rescuing Wall Street. That book came out in 2012 in hardcover, and then again in soft cover just recently and got a boost when people started reading it. John Stewart had him on the show. He was on Bill Moyers. Neil Borofsky, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
I want to ask you about that right off the bat. The book came out in 2012, didn't get the same kind of attention that it's getting now. Is that because we are in the midst of a presidential campaign? What do you think?
No, I mean, look, I think we did pretty well when it came out. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks, and you know, we certainly got a great bump with the soft cover. I think it's sort of remarkable how much Jon Stewart, how many people watch Jon Stewart, and then how many people who watch it buy books. So it's been great to have a second life. But you know, it's one of the things that the issues that are raised in the book, you know, are not frozen in time. And you know, this morning, right now, you have the officials of the biggest of the two big to fail banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, getting grilled by the Senate for you know the most recent scandal, the most recent demonstration of how out of control their size are, how they're too big to manage, how they profit off of the subsidy they still enjoy from being too big to fail in connection with the so-called whale trade in which they lost $6 billion. So it drives home the fact that so many of the bad incentives that drove us over the cliff in 2008 and caused this devastating financial crisis, they're still there. They're still in place, and we still live with these problems. And I think the book helps touch on a nerve that when we had an opportunity in 2008 to really remake our financial system, to really take advantage of and learn from the devastation that hit our economy, that we took a very, very wrong path. And all we did was pour hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars into these banks and preserved instead of disrupted that status quo. And the book helps explain why that all happened.
When you got there, did you have a sense that there was going to be that other path taken?
You know, to be honest with you, when I first took the job, I was a former prosecutor. I'd spent 8 years, the latter part of my career, doing mostly securities fraud and mortgage-based fraud. And my number one concern when I took the job of Special Inspector General for TARP was to focus on the agency's law enforcement function. And we were like a mini FBI for TARP-related crimes. We had investigators, special agents who arrested people, who executed search warrants. And when I got to Washington in December of 2008, I really thought that was going to be my focus, was to try to deter people from stealing from the program, catching and referring for prosecution those criminals who inevitably would, and working with Treasury to deter potential fraud. That's really where I thought my job was going to be. But I found out pretty quickly, as I started dealing with the Treasury officials who were running the TARP program, that I was going to have to do a lot more to fulfill my oath to protect taxpayers. When I saw just how deferential they were to the banks and how little concern they seemed to have about the real opportunities the banks would have to criminally profit off of these programs. And, you know, they were designing these programs with conflicts of interest, with huge loopholes, with really no mechanisms to carry out their policies. So it was only after I started focusing my efforts there and trying to protect the taxpayer from in that perspective that I got to see the real size and scope of the problem and see how, rather than fixing those problems, our government officials were so enthralled with the banks that they were rescuing that it was all about maintaining their status quo, rebuilding their power, instead of doing what we needed to do, which was to break them up.
Was Treasury Secretary Geithner enthralled to the banks, like enthralled by the banks, or enthralled to the banks?
You know, it certainly seemed at times that both, to be honest with you. And what, you know, it's ultimately the actions speak louder than words. And what we saw was that sort of at every key decision point, where an opportunity was to choose between what was in the best interest for the bank's bottom line and what was in the best interest for the American taxpayer and for all those who were supposed to be helped by TARP other than the largest financial institutions, that under Secretary Geithner's watch, he always chose the banks. So, you know, I think that one of the best examples of this was, you know, TARP was supposed to do something about the foreclosure crisis. They never get the votes in Congress to pass that bill, absent a very explicit promise to use TARP funds to deal with the foreclosure crisis, to help struggling homeowners who in many ways were on the front line of victims of the financial crisis. And even though there were numerous opportunities to do so, Secretary Geithner and the Treasury Department did not use TARP in that manner. They announced an ineffective program, but never put the money behind it and never took care in the design of that program to help homeowners. Instead, in which he, in one case where the words really did follow the actions, he explained to us at an oversight meeting that this program was much more concerned about, to use his words, to foam the runway for the banks, to extend out the foreclosure crisis and to protect their bottom line, than it was to help the millions of homeowners who were supposed to get the benefit of TARP funds. So I think when you look at the actions and the decision not to pursue remedies against the banks as they were abusing homeowners under this program instead of carrying out what they were supposed to do, the deference that I saw on a daily basis, it certainly seems that they were consistently putting the interests of those banks over that of everyone else.
But Geithner has been somebody who's sort of been, he's not been part of that Wall Street revolving door, has he? He was in Treasury, he was in the Fed, he's been more of sort of a public service banker, hasn't he?
In some respects, but it's important to note that when you're at the New York Fed, and the New York Fed has traditionally had the role within the Federal Reserve System of being, frankly, representing the bank's interests within the broader Federal Reserve System, that's really a quasi-public-private entity. And, the New York Fed itself identifies it. But I think far more important than that is if you look at the way that Tim Geithner did the job, who he surrounded himself with, both at the New York Fed and when he came to Treasury, I think it shows you a lot about his ideology. And particularly when I was dealing with him and his team at Treasury, the key people, the decision makers, all came from the major financial institutions who were the recipients of the bailout. We saw Bear Stearns official. We saw key decision-making, his senior advisors. When you're the president of the New York Fed and you look at your board and the people you surround yourself, again, it's the CEOs of those largest financial institutions. So while it's certainly true that he'd never worked at Goldman Sachs or one of the big banks, it's not uncommon for certain regulators to absorb that ideology, and I think Tim Geithner is a sort of textbook example of someone's over everyone else.
Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street, is by former Special Inspector General of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, Neil Barofsky. You write in the afterword, part of the current economic malaise can be traced directly to Treasury's betrayal of its promise to use TARP to preserve homeownership. Give me an example. Extend that out a little more. Go in a little more deep.
Mortgage payments more affordable through a government program, and therefore they wouldn't get tossed out in foreclosure. And as we know, foreclosures have devastating impact, not just on the family that's thrown out on the street, but on entire neighborhoods. It hurts property values. It continues to depress property values. People have less money to spend to stimulate an economic recovery. And this was a crisis that was caused by a real estate bubble, and ultimately our recovery has been stymied unnecessarily for the principal reduction, the amount of people that people owed on their home loans. And so many Americans became so underwater on their loans, meaning they owed more than their houses were worth after the real estate bubble popped. And a real common sense approach that really could have unlocked a lot of value for homeowners, that could have had really had supported an economic recovery, which would have been a broad principal reduction program. And Geithner and his team fought that tooth and nail every time that we or others do so, not to pursue any of these plans, not to pursue those goals. And they took this program, which was supposed to help up to 4 million people, and even though they had packed it with conflicts of interest, which made it more profitable for the banks that were essentially running this program at times to foreclose rather than to modify, they didn't do anything to change those incentives, and they didn't do anything to change that program. And I think a lot of it was out of this political fear that they would be painted as helping unworthy homeowners or some other type of nonsense. And they would often say to us that they were concerned about the moral hazard, the idea that an undeserving homeowner might get a break. And this is particularly ironic, given that all the undeserving large banks, which had, you know, driven our economy off the cliff, were getting a huge amount of subsidies. And then that was sort of, I think, the opportunity that they had and that they deliberately chose not to use.
You know, the critics of even the critics of TARP, but also the CBO and others say, look, TARP, in the end, it didn't cost $700 billion, it spent like $400 billion. The government, Treasury says the government might have made $23 billion profit on the program. I mean, and they also say, look, because of TARP, messy as it was, we forestalled a greater crisis. What's your analysis?
Well, first of all, you know, I agree that it's good news that losses on TARP are going to be far less than we had imagined. And just to be clear, I mean, Treasury, it really shows you how manipulative Treasury can be with the numbers, because a lot of people are under the impression that Treasury is saying that TARP will turn a profit. Treasury's own numbers, as they report to Congress, when they don't slice and dice and shade and sort of manipulate the truth a little bit, indicates a loss of around, you know, in the neighborhood of close to $50 billion in losses. So that's Treasury's own number. CBO puts the loss numbers less, I think, in the 20s. But still, whatever it is, those numbers, they're not gains, but it's still far less than we thought. And that is certainly a positive aspect of TARP. And the fact that we avoided a larger, deeper financial crisis, and I strongly believe, I think I was probably one of the first people to recognize that TARP played an important role in keeping things from getting far worse. And potentially a much more devastating financial crisis, it deserves some degree of credit for that. But that does not mean that having done that TARP is a success. The idea of just shoveling money into the banks to keep them from failing is, first of all, that's not remarkably complex. It is really not something to pat yourself too hard on the back for. But more importantly, when Treasury pitched that as a basis for TARP, Congress rejected it. They rejected it squarely. And they said, no, we're not going to give you money just to rescue the banks, even if you don't lose that much money. You need to do more. You need to help homeowners. Treasury itself, when it put the money in the banks, this is sort of gets rewritten in history, but what they said was, hey, we're going to give this money to banks, and our goal is not so much to save them, but it's so that they would deploy the money, so they would use it to lend, so that homeowners and businesses and small businesses can rebuild. And of course, what happened was that never happened because Treasury put no conditions in place. They put no incentives in place. They fought tooth and nail when we tried to bring transparency to that process, all of which meant that goal was never met. So sure, it is true and it is a good thing that TARP helped prevent prevent the crisis from getting far worse. But that alone doesn't make it a success, and by its own standards, by its own stated goals, Treasury failed to meet the goals of TARP when it came to restoring the economy, restoring lending, assisting homeowners. And I think the second part of my response is, great, we saved our financial system. Well, what is it exactly that we saved? We papered over a tremendously broken system that benefited a few executives and a few giant banks and drove something to the order of $13 trillion in losses because of this financial crisis. And when we were presented with that, what did we do? We took the two big to fail banks that had driven the crisis, and through TARP and other mechanisms, we made them even bigger. We took too big to fail, and we cemented it as the status quo. You know, we had an opportunity to take steps to prevent another financial crisis, and instead what we did is we took steps that, in my view, have made another crisis potentially more devastating all the more likely.
In what ways?
They're bigger. As I said, they're big before. They're 25% bigger now. All those bad incentives to take on risk, and again, that's on display this morning in front of the Senate subcommittee, looking at J.P. Morgan Chase, to use the advantages you get from a depressed cost of funding because of the assumption that you'll be bailed out, something that got solidified when we actually bailed them out, that incentives taking on huge risks for the opportunities of huge profits if the bets go well, and not really worrying about the losses because the taxpayers will step in. We see now that the Attorney General of the United States of America testifying in front of Congress that some banks are so big and so interconnected that we can't actually hold them criminally accountable as we would if they were smaller because of their size, because of the fear that if we indict them, that they can bring down the system. I mean, that creates, not only does that unfair and creates a two-tiered system of justice, it incentivizes crime, it incentivizes taking risks, going over the line, all things that will push us further and further to a more dangerous situation and potential crisis.
We have a Fed governor going before a conservative political action committee saying we need to break up the big banks. We have the end of, we're coming close to the statute of limitations on some of the criminality and criminal actions that were taken by these banks. They haven't been prosecuted. Many have not been prosecuted. What's the step to unwind this? We also have Mary Jo White. She's going to be SEC, Securities and Exchange Commissioner. You're sort of saying, let's see what she actually does. We have the Consumer Protection Agency. So we have some things in place. You think that Dodd-Frank has made things worse. What are the steps we take to break up the banks?
Well, you know, it is one of those things where, I mean, this is something I was calling for when I stepped down at Sig Turpin sometime before, but it is remarkable how much more momentum the movement to break up the banks has received in recent days. And you know, you watching the Senate hearing today and seeing both from the left and the right, you know, John McCain and, you know, other conservative senators as well as, you know, the progressives calling for breaking up the big banks is a tremendous amount of movement. Now, I don't know if we yet have enough to break through the very, very powerful vice-like grip the large banks have on Washington. But this is some significant progress. And, you know, there are a number of proposals out there, which, you know, frankly, I believe that they all should be used, that we shouldn't look at them in isolation, that they all have value. And, you know, you're talking about, I think you're referring to Richard Fisher, who's testifying in front of, or not testifying, who's speaking to CPAC today. And what he advocates is, and I think what a lot of different folks advocate, both in government and out, is putting a size cap on the banks that just basically says they can only be so big, and they got to trim down to get down to that size. And this was a bill that was proposed during the Dodd-Frank debate that had bipartisan support and really got knocked down by the Treasury Department and the White House, who lobbied against it. You have much higher capital requirements, so the banks are doing more of their business with their own money and not borrowed money, which seems like a very basic and common sense idea that should be followed. And then the third thing is going back to what worked for decades and decades after the last giant financial crisis, the Great Depression, and separating out the commercial banking stuff, the boring banking stuff, you know, taking deposits and making loans from all of this exotic investment bank, complex trading and derivatives, all these things that get away from the socially useful aspects of banking, and basically saying, look, if you're going to be a bank and don't be anything else, and you know, so that we don't have to support those other activities. And I think all of those are terrific ideas that I'm hoping will be pursued.
All right, sir. I hope we can talk again. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Neil Borofsky's book is Bailout, How Washington Abandoned Main Street While Rescuing Wall Street. And now.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. Sound of the week.
The sound comes to us from a mile down the Pipiwa Trail on Maui. The trail is surrounded by a deep bamboo forest. Plants are 100 feet tall, some as wide as 4 inches. And as the winds blow, the tops of the massive bamboo plants knock into each other. Oh yeah, you can hear that. Thanks to weekday listener Mike, who sent that in. Lucky enough to be hiking that trail, a warm 85-degree day. Ah, Hawaii. We just don't have that kind of Hawaiian weather when we need it. Nick Bond, I don't know, but that we would do a lot better with a little more Hawaiian weather, if you don't mind my saying so.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
I knew you would say that. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. All right. Winter, though, looks like winter might be over soon.
Well, it's definitely in the rearview mirror. And so I thought, you know, it might be worth reviewing how well we did in terms of the climate model forecast for the season as a whole. And that's relevant because the forecast made last summer for this winter are kind of like the ones we're making right now for next summer. And so anyway, what the models were indicating for Washington State was slightly warmer than normal, somewhat less precipitation than usual. And that was the consensus from seven of the climate models that are used by NOAA for that purpose, and an idea I'd like to kind of return to just in a moment. How they actually did, the actual weather, it was near normal temperatures for the state as a whole, a little cooler on the west side of the Cascades, a little warmer on the west side, and it was drier than normal, so not too bad.
Not too bad. So if you were give me a baseball analogy.
Well, there, it's, yeah, it's like the, you know, the pundits as a whole were saying that the Mariners were going to struggle, and you know, they came in the lower part of their division.
Yeah, it sounds like the models were maybe hitting better than 500. Better than a baseball team.
But they were not unanimous, and that tells us something. It is when they're all saying the same thing, it's a lot more reliability in the forecast than if they have wildly divergent opinion, just like the pundits, if they're all thinking that the Mariners are going to go to the World Series. Well, now, wait a minute. That's kind of an unrealistic example. Let's say they're all saying the New York Yankees are going to go to the World Series. Then you have a pretty good confidence they're going to have at least a good overall season.
So then we should look to that. I know past performance is no indication of future earnings, but should we look to that for the summer predictions?
Yeah, and I guess I'd like to talk about that in a little bit more detail next week, if I could defer there. There's going to be the new official forecast out of the Climate Prediction Center.
I shall let you do that. And tell me, what's the weather going to be like this weekend?
Yeah, here it's kind of on the cloudy, cool, and damp side. Today, the shower's probably cranking up this afternoon, but balmy overnight. Tomorrow, the morning maybe not too bad, but definitely a good chance of showers in the afternoon, a little cooler, and especially a chillier night tomorrow night with mid-30s to around 40. Sunday, cooler yet, but probably a little drier. And then but continuing into Monday, maybe a break on Tuesday. And then finally, on Wednesday, a decent storm kind of moving in off the Pacific. It's kind of interesting. A couple of days ago, it looked like there was going to maybe be some cold Canadian air with it, but alas, that no longer looks the case. And so, but we can look forward to the chance of it drying out late week into next weekend.
I like how I'm hoping for Hawaiian weather, and you're hoping for a little erratic cold coming down from Canada.
Yeah.
All right. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. I appreciate you talking to us again, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll follow up next week with the predictions. He also is at the Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. We will review the news of the week coming up on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
KUOW 94.9, News and Information. It's 10 o'clock.
In Basque Country right now, they're trying to wake up nature and usher in spring.
In the Basque Country, we celebrate.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.